Accession number 29424, Reel 13.
Play. Paul Erstreicher, Reel 13. I think you're now going on to the Bomber-Harris affair, are you, Paul? Which is linked, I believe, with Coventry, isn't it?
Well, it happened in my Coventry time, of course. There is no direct link between what happened in London and Coventry Cathedral, but I'm the link in a way, because this somewhat extraordinary event in British history became, to me, a great symbolic event. We've got to remember exactly what happened. It all began with the Royal Air Force, commanded by Air Marshal Harris, bombing the bloody daylight out of the German people. I mean, it was a policy that Churchill, after the war, even came to regret. But it was a policy that today, by present human rights law standards, and you know the way they talk about war being having collateral damage, means civilians get killed accidentally, as it were, incidentally. But that wasn't the policy in the Second World War. The policy was kill as many Germans as possible. It went so far as the air crew, when they were over German cities, were instructed to destroy the working class areas rather than the middle class areas. And the reason they were given was that working class people live closer together and you can kill more of them in one go. Whereas middle classes live in a dispersed way and the bombs wouldn't be so effective. So killing as many people as possible was the actual objective of Harris's strategy, on the assumption this will wreck German morale and shorten the war. What it did is strengthen German morale and make German people even more angry at what was being done to them. But certainly, by present-day standards, the deliberate killing of civilians, which was the policy both in Germany and Japan, would be regarded as a war crime. And Harris was its, in both senses of the word, executioner, and believed in it. And of course his own air crew, called him Butcher Harris, but what they meant, not that he was butchering Germans, but he was sacrificing huge numbers of his own men. Because the losses to Bomber Command were higher than the losses to any other branch of the British Armed Forces. They went on almost suicide missions. They knew they might not come home. And that was a price that Harris was willing to pay. He was willing for his own men in large numbers to get killed, as well as many Germans as possible. Well, when the war ended, there were rueful thoughts in government about what had been done. When they went into Germany and saw the effects of the bombing. It wasn't just Dresden. Dresden became a symbol of it because it was right at the end of the war. But actually more people were killed in Hamburg than in Dresden, much earlier. It was a general policy. Kill as many Germans and one city after another. You know, they were just ticked off. And when the war was over, there was a lot of head shaking. And Harris was the only commander of a British military unit, major unit, who was not given a peerage in the House of Lords. He was very embittered by this. He was kind of the scapegoat. He was blamed for what was more or less recognised to have been a mistake. He emigrated to South Africa. And by most standards, most people would say he was not a very nice bloke. But, I mean, that's neither here nor there. He symbolised what those men went through. Well, years after, I've forgotten which year it was, the survivors of Bomber Command saw that outside the RAF church on the Strand, there was a beautiful statue to the commander of the fighter pilots. I think that was Lord Tedder, if I'm not mistaken. But no statue to their commander. And really, they collected the money to put up a statue to their commander. And it was almost like putting up a statue to themselves. And I had sympathy with that. Those men survived, their comrades died, and I could understand what they were doing. They weren't glorifying killing Germans. They were veterans whose own effort had not been rewarded. And so they collected the money to put up a statue to their commander. And in its way, I thought this was legitimate. On the other hand, when everybody in the peace movement and lots of other people, including the British government, found this was rather distasteful. And yet you couldn't stop them doing it. And in the end, they did it. It was very interesting that no member of the government was present when it was unveiled. But who had to do the unpleasant thing? The dear old Queen Mother, who was the patron of Bomber Command, and she wouldn't have turned those men down. So Queen Mother came, but Margaret Thatcher stayed away. It was a very dynamic British situation. And of course, I was torn in my sympathies. As I say, I understood those men, and yet to put up a statue to a man who was called Butcher Harris for good reasons also seemed highly distasteful, because it was a way of saying, you know, what we did was okay. It would say that to a lot of people. And so I conferred with my friends in the peace movement, what should we do? And they said, well, we should have a counter demonstration when it's unveiled. And I prevailed on them not to do that. I said, look, this would lack dignity. These old men who will unveil it and have paid for it must be respected. But yes, we should have a demonstration. Let's demonstrate a week beforehand, when actually the
the plinth,
that's right. Mm. The plinth will be there, but the statue won't yet be there. Let's put something different on the plinth as a demonstration. Let's make a great big dove of peace, and let's march through Trafalgar Square and then make our way up the Strand with this dove of peace, and have a peace demonstration there, but not against other people, but to say something positive. And we did. And I found that very moving. And people seemed to be very sympathetic to what we were doing. Of course, the police were there and so on, but it was all a very peaceful event, and it was a symbol of what we felt. But now, how does all this impinge on Germany? And that was, of course, the main reason the government was unhappy, because they wanted good relations with Germany. You know, Germany's part of NATO, Germany's the new ally, the war's a long time ago, and you didn't want to offend the Germans. And this would undoubtedly offend the Germans. That was now the sort of the bottom line, and why the government felt so uncomfortable. And inevitably, being who I am, well known in Germany, many German journalists descended on me, asked me to comment. And most of them were, of course, outraged, as Germans were. I mean, this was, as it were, the British nation, as far as the Germans felt. This is the British nation celebrating what many Germans felt was mass murder. And so it fell to me to say to these German journalists, help the German people to understand what was actually happening. This was not an anti-German move. It was not a comment on the Second World War. It was a lot of old men celebrating their survival. And the poor old Queen Mother was not actually the British state, although it very well looked like it. It wasn't the Queen. It was an old woman who happens to be a patron of the Royal Air Force. And you've got to understand that Margaret Thatcher was not there, and interpret that positively. You've got to help German people to understand. And then my sort of punchline to the Germans was, just imagine Germany had won the Second World War. Just imagine that in your mind for a moment, and think of the statues that there would be in Germany today. Just think of the sort of statues there would be to Heinrich Himmler and Goering and all the war criminals that were killed in Nuremberg. They'd all be there in stone. Just imagine that, and try to interpret that to the German people. So it was an event that had me, as it were, on both sides of the argument. Of course, I'd rather it had never been put there. But I could understand why it was put there. And I could see and empathize with the veterans who put it there. But I could, of course, feel with the German people who couldn't understand these subtleties. A statue to them is a statue, and the British royal household present is enough to say this is what the British nation is doing.
Am I right in thinking that there was an appeal made to Coventry Cathedral to try and stop the statue, and they refused? Am I right in thinking that?
I think you're not right.
No.
I have no memory of such an appeal. I mean, I can imagine that the odd letter was written to Coventry Cathedral, or maybe even to me, by individuals saying, couldn't you stop this thing? I don't specifically remember such letters, but I wouldn't be surprised if they existed. Mm-hmm. And possibly even to me, and I don't remember, and I would have replied in the sort of terms that I've said to you.
Yeah.
I said, Coventry Cathedral has no power to stop anybody putting up a monument to themselves, you know.
It's perhaps what I'm thinking of, perhaps. So, some of your articles, because I know I read, you wrote several articles about it, didn't you, in the British press? Was it in The Guardian that I would have read it?
Yeah, I don't remember now. I think I wrote more in Germany than I did in Britain at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it is perfectly possible that, I mean, certainly no official German source asked Coventry to intervene. That would have been a major issue. We would have had a meeting with the bishop and saying, you know, can we do this? And I think the answer would have been no. The answer would have been, look, these men have the right to put this up. We may not like it, but we certainly would not stop it.
It was interesting in as much that it created so much public debate, didn't
yeah.
it?
Well, within 2 days of it being unveiled, in big black letters at the foot of it, were the words war criminal on it, and that went through the German press. In other words, British people putting that on it, in other words, showing that there was a debate in Britain going on. That impressed quite a lot of Germans, that clearly somebody here had protested in that kind of way. But no, I have no memory of anything even semi-official approaching Coventry on this matter.
Your present position at Sussex University, I believe you are a chaplain there, is that right?
That's right.
Yes. So do you have any... Does it relate in any way to the work you did at Coventry?
No.
You know, in as much the reconciliation or...
No, I mean, it's very much simpler than that. When I left Coventry, it was into what I regarded as genuine retirement in terms of jobs. I mean, I still had plenty to do, to write, to speak, to be myself. But I had no ambition of any kind to be part of an ecclesiastical institution anymore. I really wanted to be retired. But as my wife is a professor on the on the campus. My wife is professor of gender studies at the university. It's not surprising that I took an interest in what was going on at the university. And it just so happened that the head of the chaplaincy team at the university is a fellow Anglican priest, and we got to know each other well in my years on the General Synod of the Church of England. And we were chatting, and he said, look, you haven't got a job. Wouldn't you like to join our chaplaincy in an honorary capacity and just be join our team? And I said, well, look, you're an Anglican priest, and the local vicar is also part of your team. You've got two Anglican priests already. Do you really want a third? And he smiled and he said, no, I'd like you to come as a Quaker. We haven't got a Quaker on our team. And so that sort of struck a chord with me. And so I said to him, well, if the local Quakers are prepared to appoint me, if they would like me to be the Quaker chaplain to the university, yeah, I'd do that as an honorary job, and, you know, with no kind of duties attached. I can make of it what I will. And that is then what the local Quakers have done. I approached them and I said, look, I've been asked, would I like to be Quaker chaplain? And then I said, well, only if you appoint me. I can't appoint myself the Quaker chaplain. And so they did. So I am now the Quaker chaplain to the University of Sussex. It's an unpaid honorary job. I can do as much or as little as I choose. But it's quite a joy and a privilege to be with a team of six other chaplains from all the other main denominations, and to share their thinking, to share in some of their activities. I'm on the campus usually not more than one day a week. It's not a major commitment. I've plenty of other things to do. But it gives me just a tiny little bit of local status. I can say I have a role on the university.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine Sussex is very international as a university.
Well, most universities are nowadays. Mm. They depend on foreign students to survive economically.
Yes.
So yes, indeed. And yes. And my own wife's, who works mainly with postgraduates, mm-hmm. and at least half of them are foreign students. And yes. Of course, I've got to know a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And it was a challenge to me because I could do some things on the campus that perhaps others haven't got the qualifications for. There was, for example, a moment when the Jewish Student Society and the Palestinian students were almost literally throwing stones at each other. And so I was approached, would I try to get them together to listen to each other? And to try to, as it were, help both sides to see that the other side had a case. And so I did that. I mean, that's the sort of reconciliation work that I've been trained to do. And, you know, an opportunity arose on the campus, and I've helped to organise, for example, a conference on campus about military chaplaincy and its role in the world today. I've helped to organise a debate on religion and its role in society, a debate that I had with Polly Toynbee of The Guardian, who's a very militant atheist. And that drew a large crowd. Yes, it's not a major part of my life, but as it were, a last honorary job. It's rather nice.
And CND, Paul, are you still involved with CND?
I'm its vice president. I'm one of five vice presidents. I've been with it almost from the beginning. It began in 1959. I've been with it since 1960. At one stage, I was vice chairman, which isn't much more important. The vice presidents are sort of honorary figureheads, if you like, who support the organisation, whereas the chairman and the vice chairman really run the organisation. So for a period, I was vice chairman. And, of course, I believe nuclear disarmament is as important today as it ever was. The dangers from weapons of mass destruction have become not less since the Cold War, which had a system of controlling it, whereas now there's very little control of whose hands these are in, and I believe it's a absolute scandal that Britain, which signed the treaty, the non-proliferation treaty, guaranteeing that it would disarm, not at once, but as a process, and which forbids other nations to acquire these weapons, that instead of living by this treaty and going through the process of nuclear disarmament over a period, we're doing the opposite. We're maintaining our nuclear so-called deterrent and spending billions on renewing it. So the cause of nuclear disarmament is terribly important, and because most people don't feel threatened by the bomb at the moment, membership of CND is now relatively small compared with what it used to be in the days when people were really frightened of nuclear war. But the organisation,
given the fact that there's so much talk about proliferation,
I know,
particularly with countries like, you know, Iraq, of course, you know, their facility was destroyed, but Iran.
But the organisation is now more of an intellectual think tank than it was. I mean, bringing to bear very expert views, but also still trying to express a major segment of public opinion. It was only a fortnight ago that I and other prominent CND figures went to Downing Street with 6,000 signatures opposing the replacement of Trident. So we handed those in at number 10, knowing perfectly well that the political reality is that no notice is going to be taken of what we did. But it still had to be done. You know, you still have to express what is intelligent, what is necessary, and what is morally essential.
You've been a peace activist since the 1940s, 50s?
Well, in a way, since my student days.
Yes.
My student days in New Zealand, so that takes us back to when I went to university in 1949. I think the first British speech I made on a public platform was when I was at a theological college in Lincoln, and on that platform were two speakers, one for the British disastrous war in Suez, 56, and the other for it. I was the one obviously against it.
Of course.
And the one for it was the student in my who had the next room in the college to mine, and he was a retired air marshal training to be an Anglican priest. Late in life, decided he wanted to be, he'd taken early retirement, he was 54. And was training to be an Anglican priest, and so he took the government side, and so he was the young student from New Zealand speaking against the Air Vice Marshal. That was on a public platform in Lincoln in 1956. That was, as it were, my first public peace engagement in Britain.
You've seen a whole history of this, haven't you, the pacifist or the anti-war movement? Do you detect particular landmarks or sort of waves in this?
Well, of course, there were. I think the real answer is the general mood in Britain has never changed very much. I think it has revolted now against the Iraq adventure, thank God, because people are intelligent enough to know this was a crazy adventure. But there is no natural support in the British psyche for pacifism. It is a minority phenomenon, and you know, I've got to face that reality. I think the very popular pacifism of the 1930s, when pacifism really was popular and had majorities, but instead of being called pacifism, now it's called appeasement. And people think that that was the very thing that helped to build up Hitler and cause the Second World War. And that's gone very deep in the British psyche, you know. We went pacifist and the result was a war.
And politicians.
And we won that war honourably. Yeah. And to win a war honourably is... for many British people today, the older generation certainly, was the last great thing Britain ever did. After that, everything was downhill. People look back to the Second World War with great pride. The only other nation that is comparable is Russia. And the truth is that it was Britain and Russia between them in two different ways that won the Second World War. Britain, to begin with, stood alone against Hitler. And at the end, without the Russians and their enormous sacrifices, it could never have been won. And so in a slightly different way, these two nations are immensely proud of the Second World War, and they won't let it go. It's part of English mythology. And the kids are still living in it. Even now, they watch war films. They still think of Germans as Nazis, because that's the sort of period they, you know, they've seen the pictures. And it's unique. Britain's the only nation that has that relation to the Second World War the way the Russians also do. That's why Russians still go around wearing their Second World War medals on the street, you know. There's nothing in Russia that they're more proud of than that. I can understand it. And, you know, Britain then went on to lose an empire. It had inglorious attempts to shore it up in Kenya and had wars against the Mau Mau and, you know, but that was the last great achievement of Great Britain. And so, in the popular mythology, war is still an acceptable thing to most people. Fortunately, most people are also intelligent enough to know that that doesn't apply to any old war. It's got to be good for Britain. And I mean, I don't think the unpopularity of the Iraq war is because of deep sympathy with the Iraqi people. It's simply recognizing this is stupid. Why should our boys go and get killed there for no good purpose, and the whole thing is worse after than before? You know, it's just plain daft, if you like. So, but it is not a sign of British pacifism.
No, there isn't the sort of intellectual background to it.
The irony is that the most militaristic of all nations in the 19th and a major part of the 20th century was almost certainly Germany. And it's Germany that, as a result of losing two world wars and losing the second one in such ignominy, Germany has become a nation of pacifists.